Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, January 26th, 2018. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Bishop, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman has joined us, yay, and Senator Wilikowski is excused. Thank you to Ann and Doug who are helping us out today. Today the committee has one item on its agenda, the subject of Alaska's oil production forecast, and we will have a presentation from the Oil and Gas Division. The annual revenue source book is the bellwether of how much money will be available to fund government every year. Underpinning that book is the oil production forecast, since petroleum revenue is the state's single largest source of funding. Understanding the production forecast and the factors that influence the trends of increase or decrease of productivity is critical to the financial literacy of the public finances in Alaska. So I welcome Dr. Paul Decker, petroleum geologist with the Division of Oil and Gas, to the table, and Mr. Ed King, Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Natural Resources. So welcome, gentlemen. If you would put yourself on the record, and remember when you change speakers, if you would identify yourself each time for the listeners as well as our recording secretary. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Decker. I'm a geologist, as you said, and I work managing the resource evaluation section in the Division of Oil and Gas in DNR.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Ed King, for the record, Special Assistant Commissioner of Natural Resources. I'm just available for questions in case they come up. I'll let the good doctor take the brunt of the work.
Thank you. So, as you said, the purpose here is to describe the fall 2017 production forecast from our division. That's the forecast for this fiscal year. So we'll start out with this outline and look at an overview and some of the highlights on production. We'll take a moment to stop and see just how our forecast is looking so far, our forecast versus recent actual months of production. We'll look at some of the reasons for some of the production growth since 2015 that we've seen, and I think we'll all agree that this is very good news. It's a good news message we're fortunate to speak about today. And we'll make a comparison back to the fall 2016 forecast and explore why some of the differences. Then we'll get into this year's forecast, just quick objectives, the primary things that we're trying to hit, and then review briefly the methodology in those three tranches of production I'm sure you're familiar with, the currently producing, under development, and under evaluation tranches of oil. Then we'll look at some of the adjustments we've made in the methodology over the last year to better meet the needs of the clients, notably yourselves and Department of Revenue. And then we'll look at some of the results, both near-term and longer-term. So this is a glimpse of how our forecast looks relative to recent production. So the dark blue dots are the monthly production averages through time. And you see the forecast beginning at the beginning of this fiscal year. And what you notice about our forecast is that we're not giving a single line. We're giving a range. And that's because everything we do in this forecast is fully probabilistic. We're trying to quantify the uncertainty as we go. And so what you'll see is that middle sort of grayish color line is our mean or our average production by month that we expect in the forecast. The upper line, the orange one, is sort of an upper, a high side case. It represents what we call our P10 case. In other words, there's a 10% chance that production may fall above that line in any given month. The lower is the P90 line, or our low side case. So there's also a 10% chance that you could be below that line if our projections are accurate. So what we're happy to say is that right now we're pretty squarely within the range, and some of these are plotting absolutely smack on the mean. So that's good. Overall, the average for fiscal year 2018 is expected to come in at just about 550,000 barrels per day, and the current departure from actual is less than a percent.
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Could you back up for a minute and hit me on that 500, did you say 550,000 barrels?
550,100 barrels of oil per day is the estimated average throughput for fiscal year 2018.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, Madam Chair, if I may elaborate.
Yes, Mr. King.
This is Ed King for the record. That 550 number is total production, including North Slope and Cook Inlet. The North Slope number is more like 533, if I remember right.
430. Right, okay.
Right.
Okay, so just looking at some of the reasons for recent growth, as you see in the graph on the right, this is just an illustration that we've been up slightly. Overall, it's not a huge percentage increase, but it's very good news to see things trending upwards after sort of a more typical pattern of several percent decline per year. So why is that? Well, we've seen recent production growth from both new fields that are coming on or new projects coming on, as well as efficiencies in some of our older large fields. So at Kuparuk Unit, for example, the drill site 2S, the Shark's Tooth project has come on. That's made a significant contribution there. The Koval River Unit is another good example. Drill site CD5 came on earlier and stronger than anticipated. So that has certainly contributed a lot to the turnaround. And in the Prudhoe Bay unit, just recently, Damian Bilbao and Janet Weiss have been speaking on the record about the reasons for some of their exceptional performance at the Prudhoe Bay unit recently. They've overall done more with less and increased operational efficiencies. So even though they're drilling fewer wells on an annual basis, they're doing a lot of things to increase, the operational efficiency. For example, there are things like non-drilling rig workovers, bringing back wells that are on the inactive list, the sick list. They're fixing these broken wells and getting them back into the game. Reservoir modeling and facilities modeling is something they do all the time, but they continue to refine those models. The reservoir models help identify targets for additional workovers or, sidetracks or things like that in the subsurface. And the facilities modeling has come a long ways towards planning the maintenance, the turnaround events. There are other issues like some of the high-tech seismic they're acquiring now, not unique to Prudhoe Bay, but that's a good example. So all those things together, even though they haven't been drilling as many wells, they've been actually increasing or holding production, I should say, pretty flat there. We also have future projects coming in the near future. In fact, already online now that we're halfway through this this forecast period or so, the 1H News project, that's pad 1H at the northeast west sack in the Kuparuk River unit. That's come on strong. The GMT-1 or Lookout discovery in NPRA is going to be coming on soon in later this year, 2018. Milne Point Moose Pad there, Hillcorp has put in a new pad where they're going to be drilling a substantial number of wells to both Kuparuk River Formation and Schrader Bluff Formation, bringing on production there. So that'll be big. Farther out, we have some of the exciting discoveries that are moving forward. For example, Pikka, the Pikka Horseshoe Trend, starting with the development in the north part of that, the Pikka unit, expected to come online maybe 2023. And the GMT-2, that's further out in NPRA from GMT-1, but it's another of these Jurassic sands, the Spark Rendezvous accumulation. And the Willow accumulation, it's similar to Pikka in some ways. It's from the Nanushik Formation. So all those things are unfolding, and we'll see how those look on a map here later on. As well, we have some pretty old discoveries that are hopefully finally moving forward, like Liberty, for example. It's been on the books for a couple of decades, but we think it may be coming into the forecast in a real way soon. So why the difference in the outlook for this year's forecast versus last year's? And if you look at the graph on the right, you can see that we're considerably more optimistic this year. What was up in 2016 that's no longer true? Well, I think it's pretty true that it wasn't just us as forecasters, but the industry in general was pretty gloomy about trends on the North Slope, especially in 2016, but all over the world, really. They were struggling with the price falling. They decreased their commitments of capital expenditures, and like 80% of the pools that we forecast in Alaska had no plans for new drilling in 2017, and all those things kind of contributed to an increasing decline story as opposed to a leveling off that we think we see now. So some of the adjustments we've made in this year's forecast. We've made adjustments because of our shortcomings in our forecast last year, I think one could say. We've learned some lessons. In the past, I think we were focused very strongly on correcting what we saw as a long-term bias towards over-optimistic or over-prediction in the long term, especially. So we put a lot of energy into fixing that last year. I think this year, realizing just how important the short-term, month-to-month seasonal fluctuation numbers are to you and Department of Revenue, we have introduced seasonal adjustments and monthly predictions into our forecast this year and a focus on the near term for the immediate budget concerns.
Dr. Decker, before you go on, so in the past, I understand that some of the data that was used in the previous methodology used some confidential information from the companies, CapEx type data. Are you doing that still?
Yes, Madam Chair. We continue to have those kinds of meetings through the Department of Revenue and with the producers. And going forward, we're very likely to actually take part directly in those same conversations. So,
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just as a follow-up on that word confidential, my understanding is that a couple times a year that the industry gives you an idea of what they expect CapEx and OpEx to be in the future, and then you guys update that data, or maybe it's once a year or what have you. So this confidential data, is that included in that discussion, or is this another data source outside of what we've normally talked about here before in the past?
I'll let Ed address this if I misspeak, but my perception is that this is something that's been included in the forecasting process for quite some time, the discussion of confidential information that we don't disclose directly, but it helps inform the overall forecast.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, and for the record, this is Ed King. The CapEx and OpEx information is information that the Department of Revenue collects in order to forecast what their tax revenues are. The Department of Natural Resources, mostly we generate our revenues off of royalties, which are gross, so we don't pay as much attention to CapEx and operational costs. So the data is given to the Department of Revenue, and it is confidential when it's given to them as taxpayer confidential information. They do share us that they do share with us that information. We sign confidentiality agreements so that we can get access to it. And then that information is included in the forecast, which we would call the under evaluation or under development layers of the forecast. And I would also point out that Senator Stedman, that was consistent with the way it's been done in the past. The other half of the forecast, though, what you would normally call the base forecast or what we call the currently producing tranche of the forecast, that's all done now with AOGCC data. Mm-hmm. So in the past, that has been done with data that was given to the Department of Revenue, and therefore it was held confidential, and it really limited the ability for us to speak to what, to disaggregate, if you will, what those numbers look like. Using publicly available data for that base forecast, we can now speak a lot more confidently and a lot more deeply about some of those fields and their production levels.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, just real brief. So it's the same data sets that historically we've used that are rolled up into the revenue source book, and it was just the terminology used is why I had that question, but it's just the same process we've used for years.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, that is correct. It is a very similar process. The difference comes from the way that we actually do the modeling. We're using the same data set, but the models that we're using are different. So in the past, they were using what we would call discrete models. Now we're using what we call stochastic models, and I think Dr. Decker will talk more about that.
Yeah. So back on the record, Paul Decker here speaking. So now we'll just launch into some more of the nuts and bolts and outcomes of the 2017 forecast itself. The objectives this year were to provide a 10-year official production forecast for the revenue sources book. In that, Department of Revenue asked us specifically to lengthen the look ahead for potential future projects to include projects not just that are coming on in the first 5 years of the forecast, as we did last time, but to increase that window to 10 years and say anything that's coming online or likely to come online during the official forecast period needs to be included in or subjected to sort of the same level of analysis and probabilistic treatment as projects that are, you know, in the first 5 years. So that's a significant change. We've also, as I mentioned, tried to increase our focus on the near-term accuracy with monthly calculations of production that show this very strong seasonality, the fluctuations summer versus winter that we all know exist, whereas previously we were just looking at straight-line annual trends. And we're placing more emphasis, especially in evaluating the currently producing fields, we're placing more emphasis on the most recent history as the better predictor of the future, rather than sort of the long-term overall trend of things. So that's important. This is just a recap slide. I'm on slide 8 to show sort of how the forecast categories fall into the forecast. So again, 10-year duration, and these three tranches of production all have sort of different timing criteria for them, as well as sort of how confident we are that, that things are really going to work out as expected. But the first one is the currently producing, and this is what Ed was talking about before. This is decline analysis of the public data to give us the oil that's flowing from existing fields currently producing. So that in general has some uncertainty, but less than these others, as we'll see in a moment. The underdevelopment tranche is oil that's flowing from projects that we expect to come online in the first year of the forecast. So it may be new wells within existing fields, or it may be new fields coming online. These, in any case, are projects that are pretty tightly scheduled and part of the annual operator budget. So these are pretty certain. Not a 100% chance that each one of these will come off as expected, but a pretty high chance. And the third then being the longer range projects under evaluation, or UE. This is oil in the forecast flowing from projects that are set to occur in years 2 through 10 of the forecast. And they do not necessarily have to be scheduled and part of an annual budget. But as you see in that chart on the right, we've now that we've incorporated projects beginning, say, years 6 through 10 of the forecast, we went ahead and just acknowledged those as a separate tier from what we had previously. So we have the UE1 being, you know, years 2 to 5, and undervaluation 2 being years 6 through 10. But they're all subjected to the same kind of probabilistic treatment, stochastic analysis, as Ed called it. There's a lot of information on slide 9. We don't need to belabor it, but just for the record to sort of clarify some of the differences between this year's and last year's. Again, this year we have a 10-year future project outlook. Previously, we really had in the official forecast just the 5-year look ahead, and things beyond that were subjected to a little bit less rigorous analysis that we called last year the pot of gold, sort of, you know, in keeping with the idea that it's a little bit vague and hard to pin down, but what we hope would happen. This year, we've tried to subject all those projects to the same level of analysis. As I've said already, monthly rates with seasonal fluctuations in this year's forecast versus the annualized rates previously. A near-term emphasis now, the greatest emphasis, but not taking our eyes off the ball for a realistic long-range outlook as well. Whereas previously we were really just trying to, not only, but we were emphasizing predicting that trend of over-prediction in the long run. And a little bit different the way we risk under-evaluation projects this year. I'll show you that we have three elements of risk that we're appraising there, or uncertainty. What's the chance of occurrence of the project within the forecast window? Something between 0 and 1, say. Then there's uncertainty about the first oil startup date. You know, when do they actually get sustained production? Operators often say they expect production in a certain year, and it's not uncommon for us to see some slippage in those schedules. So this accounts for sort of a range of start dates. And finally, the probabilistic range in the expected profile of a development if it does come online. And we handle that, as I'll show you, with type wells that are not just discrete estimates but have ranges in themselves. So this is just a review of how we address the uncertainty. What does the uncertainty in each tranche look like, and how do we handle it? In the currently producing tranche, it has a relatively small uncertainty range because, especially for some of our older fields, we've got a pretty well-established behavior that we can predict into the future. So we're doing decline curve analysis projections and using special software that's been developed at our request by Schlumberger to help us get a quantitative estimate of the probabilistic range, everything from P90 to mean to P10 cases, so low, medium, high. For the projects under development, UD, we acknowledge that there's more uncertainty than CP, but as I said before, it's a pretty high likelihood that those projects are going to happen. And I think in this category, we assign about a 95% chance for each one of those projects of their occurrence. And then as far as the magnitude of the production, again, it's these probabilistic type wells that you use sort of a template of type wells building up on top of each other to simulate the peaking or the production from a series of wells being drilled. So again, those are probabilistic, and it draws samples from a range of possible type well production profiles, and in the Monte Carlo stochastic roll-up, it comes out with the mean and the ranges. Likewise, the projects under evaluation, this is the least certain. There's financial risk, there's occurrence risk, there's the price forecast certainly is unsure, but that would have to factor into this as far as whether a project's going to go ahead. And as I said, we risk the chance of occurrence within the window, the timing of sustained production, and the production profile, again, with these probabilistic type wells. So I hope I'm not being too redundant here. You're hearing some of the same themes, but at least the message should get through. So as far as the near-term focus in 2017, again, the decline curve analysis, by weighting that analysis and telling the software to start by looking at the most recent years, say the last 2 to 5 years, it does a look back through the other data and comes out with a probabilistic range from P90 to P10 of what production in each of those pools should look like in the future. And another change that we've introduced this year from the previous is that we're giving full credit to all the planned projects in the under development category. Previously, we had sort of a logical, intuitive sense that the decline curve analysis of the historical production factors in some level of base drilling activity or workover activity, and that's true. But we found that we were certainly underestimating last year by discounting as much as we did of the UD production. And so we find empirically that this makes for a more accurate near-term production. The first 6 months, it looks like we're on track doing the right thing here. And the other important point is that logically, leaving those UD projects in there helps make up for the rate increases that are also inherent in the historical data that come from non-drilling rate-adding jobs, the non-rig workovers, the facility streamlining, debottlenecking, and other operational efficiencies that are being squeezed out of the fields. So this is a significant change, and I'm glad that we introduced it this year.
Senator Stedman.
Maybe could we have him talk a little bit about whatever it fits into the presentation, how they plan on dealing with the 1002 potential? How that works with such a little information that we have, and then the impact that may have, synergy impact on Point Thompson?
Good question.
Through the chair, that is a very good question, Senator Stedman, and really for the purposes of our forecasting, we do not include, even in the under evaluation, projects that have not resulted in any discovery of oil. So ANWR is excluded from that on that grounds. We might also exclude it based on expectation of production within 10 years. But primarily, the reason we are not entertaining prospective resources is that it has not yet yielded any discovery to evaluate, so to speak.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, I can recognize that, but there is expectations that there's going to be a bunch of seismic work, leases, and of course litigation, unfortunately, and we'll move that into production. And is there any information or guesstimation that you can give the committee on, you know, that type of a time horizon, because or when you think that may come about, regardless if you're, you know, formally using it in your model or not, because one of the reasons for that is the burdensome cost of the royalties, not the royalties, but the tariffs at Point Thompson. And the quicker we can get the throughput up there and get those tariffs down, the better we're going to be at Point Thompson, even though, you know, we're, as we all know, we only get, what, half the royalties or what have you at, off of the 1002.
So I understand the desire to know more about ANWR and how it's going to play in on things. I also don't know that we have a good way to address all those things, but I would let Ed chime in.
As Senator Stemmett, through the chair, one of the most difficult things to do is to forecast out into the future, and the further out into the future you get, the more things can happen, and the more difficult it becomes to make any kind of predictions that have any kind of value. So that's really the reason why we reevaluate our forecasts every year and update those forecasts as we're getting new information. So what we don't want to do, and historically, at one point at least in the Department of Revenue's forecasting history of production forecasts, they did attempt to include, you know, fields that were yet to be found. And when you look at those forecasts and compare them to what actually happened, they're overly optimistic. And so what we did is we tried to not completely just throw out the production from those fields that aren't well delineated or that we don't have a lot of information. What we tried to do is honor the amount of information that we don't have. So we apply a chance factor. We apply a range of uncertainty around production, when it might occur, and a range of production around what rate it might occur at. And all of those uncertainty factors are thrown into the model. And what it spits out is, instead of saying, you know, a unit or a field is going to come on at 100,000 barrels 10 years from now per day, we'll say we'll include 5,000 of those barrels based on what we know now. And as we continue to move forward, we're continuing to reassess what we know, updating our model, and if the project continues to stay on schedule, then we get more and more contribution to the forecast.
So Paul Decker back on the record, and Senator Stedman, what I really should have mentioned a moment ago is that the division's commercial section has undertaken an analysis, a potential model of potential production and revenues from ANWR from the 1002, and that's been undertaken, and that should be available, I believe, online in the division's website, if it's not available right now. But let us look into that as far as the availability of that. That's been good work that's been conducted quite separately from our forecasting for the Department of Revenue. So, yeah, we can get you the details on that. Thanks. So if we can just tumble to the forecast results, I'm on slide 12. And what you see here is the black line starting at the left in the late 1980s, peaking, this actual production, peaking at over 2 million barrels a day off the North Slope, largely off the North Slope, I should say. This is a statewide forecast. But pretty well declining ever since, with the exception of the early 2000s, when we saw some flattening of the production, largely because of the Alpine Coal River discovery coming online. But what you see there in the red box is the part I want to zoom into next, and you'll see a little bit more clearly on this figure 13. Again, the black line showing the last 3 years of actual production. Now, the blue line going forward from this fiscal year and out 10 years into the future, the blue line represents our mean forecast with monthly data points. And the whiskers there represent the range of uncertainty from our low side P10, or P90 rather, to our high side P10 case. And something that you'll notice is that the whiskers grow longer in the out years of the forecast, simply reflecting less certainty over long range forecasts. This is good, and we think we're happy with the nearly seamless join there between history and forecast. That's something that last year's forecast didn't have, partly because we weren't calculating monthly based on the seasonal fluctuations. So what you see is pretty well flat for the next couple of years, and then in the mean case anyway, and then in the mean case mostly declining, but at a pretty low rate. I think it's 1.5 or 2% overall, looking out in the future years beyond that. So it's a pretty darn low rate of decline. Then looking into the long range, medium to long term, this is a map showing under evaluation projects and where they fall. This is 14 of the 18 or so long range evaluations that we're looking at. There are a few off the screen to the right, like Liberty is mentioned, also some Point Thompson and some other things. But mostly the future that we're looking at right now originates sort of in the central part of the western North Slope. So everything from about Milne Point and Kaparik Field west into the middle of NPRA. So you see quite a few there clustered just west of Kaparik, some new fields that we hope we'll see come online. And then let me call your attention. I don't know if I can point with the mouse, but you'll see the Pica discovery there. Yeah, the mouse. Yeah, there we go. The Pica discovery in the Pica unit. That's a Pica development in the Nanushik and the Alpine beneath that. And so that's really going to trend down here, very likely unfold as a prospect that goes clear through that next red star, the CRU fifth expansion, and down here to where the horseshoe well was drilled last year at this time as a discovery showing that trend. So that'll likely unroll as a series of developments, not all at one time. And then nicely illustrated just to the west of that are the four stars starting in the Kobol River unit and going southwest. So Fjord West, GMT-1, GMT-2, and Willow represent what looks like kind of a steady treadmill of projects that we expect to be falling off the assembly line into the hopper, sort of in a steady flow over the next several years. Smith Bay is quite a ways out to the west. That's the Kalis Tulamonic fans in the Torok Formation. The first thing that jumps out is just how far away it is from infrastructure, so it's challenged on that basis. Not to say that it can't happen, but there's a lot of the technical information still to be learned on that prospect. We do not yet have flow tests, for example, or conventional cores, and with just two wells in it, it's really too early to know how that's going to perform precisely, but yet it is in our forecast.
Before you go on, Dr. Decker, Senator von Imhoff had a question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. So you sort of hit it on the head when you talked about Smith Bay being so far out there, and one of the issues I think that is becoming more prevalent, we're talking about are roads and connecting all seasons with these different wells. When producers are unable to access their wells for even an additional month, it does have a ripple effect over time in their ability to produce oil. What is your department's opinion on promoting year-round road building? What do we need to do to be able to get permits and permission to do that?
I will say that I'm here to talk about the forecast, and I probably can't speak for my commissioner, but I do know that DNR is very actively supporting the A-STAR project, for example, connecting communities and the other benefits that brings through interconnected road systems. So, Ed?
Senator von Imhoff, through the chair. Yes, one of the projects that we're working through right now is what we commonly refer to as the A-STAR project, which was funded last year. And one of the goals of that project is to connect communities throughout the North Slope. And as a byproduct of connecting those communities, we expect those roads to also act to open up some of the access to resources as well. We are in the early phases of that. We just issued some contracts related to that work. We're actually in the process of scheduling a hearing on that topic, so I think we can, in this committee, and I think we could talk about it more in depth when we have that hearing, if you're okay with waiting.
Yes. Yes, I would very much like to learn more in the step-by-step process, as in what you need to do to get A-STAR from concept to completion, what the roadblocks are, no pun intended here, time frame and so forth, and then potential growth from there. A-Star, I believe, was it one big road, or is it a spider web of roads? Those are the kind of things I'd like to know.
Thank you, Senator Von Hohoff, the Chair. We will take that into consideration as we prepare our materials for the committee.
Senator Bishop.
Just some commentary, ma'am. We had to build 425 miles of road to get to Prudhoe, so I think we can do this.
Okay, thank you. I'll just wrap up. Oh, and I guess Ed had a point he'd like to make.
Madam Chair, the going back a slide, this is Ed King again for the record. Paul, Dr. Decker was talking a moment ago about the treadmill of projects that are coming online, and I just wanted to make sure that we really clearly illustrated the fact that those projects coming online as one project comes online and it starts to decline, you have another project that's coming online to replace that decline rate. That's what's creating that smoothing and that flat looking production forecast that we have right now. It isn't to suggest that the wells are no longer declining. It's just that we're able to replace the rate that we're lost in the wells that are producing with new wells. And as we look forward and as these projects become more defined and their schedules become more defined, we might find that some of those projects overlap. And so we'll see a spike in production and then a decline in production. And as we update every year, we'll have more information about what those profiles really look like. So I just caution people that are looking at the production forecast today not to assume that we're saying that production is going to be flat necessarily. What we're saying is that we have, in at least our most likely scenario, we have these projects coming in line such that it has that appearance.
So, Mr. King, before we go on, Smith Bay is, as you pointed out, quite a ways out there. And so either for you or Mr. Decker, where does it fall in your prospectivity?
Madam Chair, we did include Smith Bay this year. It would normally, in historic forecasts, not have been included because it was beyond the 5 years. We are now looking out further into that 10-year window, so the Smith Bay is within that window if it stays on track. But there are a lot of things between now and 10 years from now that could happen, and maybe that project works and maybe it doesn't. We don't know. We really don't want to start, spending that money before we have it. So the contribution of Smith Bay to the forecast is relatively small today. But as we move forward and get more information, as long as they stay on schedule, you're going to see the contribution from Smith Bay in our forecast increasing.
Thank you.
So Paul Decker back on the record, if I can just go ahead and offer this one as our last real slide. It's number 15. This is, look at this as a portfolio roll-up. Now it has a skin, so to speak, or a layer for each of the 18 projects that we have in the future evaluation stages. I do apologize first. I'd like to correct a typo in that title. I've called these all under evaluation projects. After I did that, I realized that we have the one project, the 1H News in the West Sac, that's already started. So that's technically not a UE project. Technically, it's UD. But the point is the same, that this is the future outlook. And now I want to caution everybody that this is best viewed as kind of a portfolio scale roll-up, just like as if you had a portfolio of stocks. Here we have a portfolio of prospects, future projects. When you look at the roll-up, this is our best estimate of how the overall portfolio should perform for 10 years out into the future. Don't look at any one of these skins or project profiles as the most likely outcome for that particular project, okay? Keep in mind that the appearance of any one skin or any one project in this graph is the product of the risking that we've applied. And again, that's the risk of, will it even occur in the 10 years? Then if it occurs, when will it start? And so that tends to spread things out in time, that component. And then there's the uncertainty about how tall the profile would be based on the probabilistic type curves that are used to build up that profile. But overall, it does give you a sense of which ones are the heavy hitters and which ones are the currently less impact in the overall profile. So some of the ones to take note of course, there's the first one that's already online here in the sort of dark brown. That's, as I said, 1H News. The dark blue wedge at the bottom across most of the plot, that's GMT1, coming in strong and better than anticipated. The sort of lilac or purple color above that is Moose Pad at Milne Point, Hill Corp's development. That's a significant one. Then going up, you see the GMT2 in sort of a dark red. That's the next big discovery coming on from NPRA. And then the Pica in the sort of greenish teal wedge, that's a very large project, of course, that we're all very excited about, and we hope that it does stay on track. You did ask specifically about Smith Bay. Well, it is in the forecast, but because of all the uncertainty, because of all the components of risk applied to that, you can barely find it actually in the graph. I think it's a thin strip up in that upper right portion of the graph. So currently, not that it won't happen, and if it happens, it may be a great thing, but currently we don't have enough to give it much confidence in the forecast. So with that, I'd just like to pause and say thank you all for listening. Thank you on behalf of the DOG 2017 team that worked on this core effort. And I'd like to acknowledge the team members there. Dr. Pascal Umekwe, he's our project lead on this. He's the one that essentially has assembled the model based on all the input from the others in the group, as well as his own judgment. So he has done a lot of work on this. Very excellent work, as has the whole team. And he's in the commercial section at DOG. The other members there, Shiragrai Sharma, John Burdick, and Steve Muthart, are in my section, the resource eval team. John and Shirag being engineers, Steve being a geologist like myself. And the group takes this very, very seriously amongst all the work they have to do. They put a lot of priority into this effort. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Decker. So on your last slide, the under evaluation projects, in the revenue source book, as you considered these, did you include the potential capital expenditures that would occur with these as you calculated in terms of revenues?
Madam Chair, so we ourselves, we're not calculating revenues, right? So I'm quite certain that revenue would take care of that side of things, Department of Revenue.
Any further questions? Yes, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation. So the only question on this slide here, I don't know why I was thinking the Willow and the Pica discoveries were about the same size, but it doesn't look like it on there. And of course, they're both being, I think, further tested this year and probably next. So I guess they could all change as we know more.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Meyer. Pica is generally estimated at 500 million to 1.2 billion barrels of oil recovery. That's kind of what the estimates are that were coming out in the public domain from Oil Search, who's just recently bought into that project, and as well as the same numbers coming out of Armstrong, at least for the development area that's currently planned. Willow, my understanding is that public announcements there have said it may be 300 million barrels in the P50 case. So that's a little smaller. Now, there may be other reasons why the profiles are different in the graph. I'd have to think about that. But
for the record, this is Ed King, and Madam Chair, I can opine on that a little bit as well if you like. Senator Meyer, through the chair, probably the clearest distinction is if you look at the number of wells that have explored those areas. You look at Willow, you have one exploration well, and you look at Pica, and you have 16. And so there's a lot more known about the resource than in one versus the other. The public announcements that have been made are relative, or some of the announcements are pegging them both at somewhere in that 100,000 barrels a day range, which might be what you're thinking about. What that doesn't include is how many wells, what's the production rate from those wells, and how long you can keep that rate and how fast it's going to decline. So just looking at a peak rate isn't a good indication of how much oil is really going to be produced. The other thing I would say is that there's a lot more uncertainty around timing as well. PICA is currently, you know, almost through the EIS process. We're waiting for a record of decision. Willow's a lot more, a lot earlier in that process. So there are still a lot of things that can affect the schedule and when those things actually end up occurring. But Conoco did announce that they're in the Petroleum News today. I think they had an article. It was talking about their exploration activities out there in the Willow, proving that up. So next year when we come back and we talk to you, maybe we'll know a little bit more.
Good. Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
So you mentioned exploration. How many wells are being drilled this winter? I think Liberty's got one, I think, and then Willow.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I have not heard about Liberty having any drilling there. There is one at Madami that we expect to see.
I guess Liberty hopes to. Isn't that the Hillcorp? And that's offshore. Okay.
That you're certainly correct about those things. I just haven't heard of a well being drilled there. We also have a well, a very long well being drilled off of Nikaichuk by ENI. It's, I think, going to be a record setting departure, a 36 or 35,000 foot well, expected to take a few months to drill. So they're in the middle of drilling that well. Then let me think. I guess Conoco has announced at least five, if not more, penetrations by the time they drill several wells at Willow and one at Stony Hill, being closer to the village of New Exit. And Conoco also drilling the Putu. Is it Putu 1 and 1A? Yeah. Putu 1 and 1A in what was formerly known as the Tofcat unit. So that's all part of that same Nanushik trend, the Nanushik Pika to Horseshoe trend. So that trend is seeing a lot of delineation, and then the Willow trend is a separate but similar trend, and it could certainly turn out larger, as Ed says, you know, with the additional exploration wells and tests and things being conducted in Willow, we may view it very differently in our future forecast. So.
One more. Senator Meyer.
Yep. Actually, two more, if that's
great.
Okay.
No, great.
So with the announcement by the Secretary of Interior of opening up more land in NPRA, do you anticipate seeing more lease sales happening soon in NPRA?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, if that in fact comes to pass, that a lot of the lands that are currently off limits to leasing become available for leasing, I would certainly expect to see future lease sales there and significant participation in extending that acreage position into lands that are currently unleasable. I would feel that's very high likelihood. Conoco, and especially Conoco, but some others, but mostly Conoco, has pretty much picked up a very large swath of acreage almost all the way over to that that eastern boundary of unleasable acreage. So I don't know why they would stop there.
And then, Madam Chair, I think it was Kalis had mentioned one of their prospects. They were here, I think, last year, said that they would need $70 oil before they could actually produce that. Was that the Nanook Nuna?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I'm guessing that was very likely Nuna, yes.
And since oil now is approaching 70 and some over 70, that maybe there'll be more activity going on there.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, potentially that's correct. The Nuna project has received royalty modification adjustments from DNR in the past, and that may be required in the future or may be requested. So,
thank you.
So,
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a little bit more of a commentary. I don't expect an answer, but I was under the impression that this was the busiest exploration season on the North Slope that we've had in the last 20 years. Hmm. And just to comment on the production forecasting, Senator Stedman probably remembers this, but you go back to a 2004 revenue sources book and look at where production was supposed to be in 2014, and it was 942,000 barrels a day. So anyway, just a comment. Thank you, ma'am.
Any further questions? All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Decker and Mr. King. Great presentation. Thank you very much. So this concludes our meeting for today. Our next meeting will be on Monday, January 29th. We will take up our first legislation of the 2018 season. Senate Joint Resolution 4 comes from Senator Olson. It relates to ivory use. And House Joint Resolution 12 comes from Representative Tarr, related to genetically engineered salmon. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect. The time is 4:19 p.m.